everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We're continuing with our ongoing series of conversations with remarkable minds. The topic today, bright green environmental lies. How the environmental movement lost its way, lost its soul, lost its heartbeat, lost its essence, lost its legitimacy for myself and many others. And yet, if you were to watch in the last, let's say, year and a half with Greta Thunberg and Al Gore and others, you would think that we are really going full steam ahead to deal with all these major environmental issues. It's not true, unfortunately. To unpack all this is Derek Jensen. Derek is speaking to us from Northern California. He has become one of the nation's leading voices of cultural and environmental dissent. He writes about civilization's devastating impact upon the environment and the natural world and our society's denial of those facts. Utney Reader listed Derek among the 50 visionaries changing the world. In sharp contrast to environmental optimists who believe working within the corporate system will offset the tenuous planetary balance threatened by climate change, for this, Derek is highly respected by those of us who are in the movement. But take an honest look at what happens when the private-corporate partnerships occur, when the government says, yes, we've got to deal with environmental issues, we're going to hire these 20 companies to help us. And you pull back and say, hold on a second. These 20 companies are among the major polluters. Are you telling us that the people who are doing the most pollution, putting us all at risk, are the ones you're asking to help us survive? That doesn't make any sense, but that's the way it works. It was over a decade ago that I was asked to be the keynote speaker at Equinox Day at the United Nations. I was there to talk about where we go from here. Unfortunately, while standing there waiting to go up, I just felt this great unease that I can't go up there and to praise the environmentalists in the room, and it was all environmental organizations and environmentalists in the room, when I had not seen their efforts come to any kind of positive fruition. I didn't see them making a better world. To the contrary, I knew some of these organizations were receiving millions of dollars from polluters, and therefore they wouldn't deal with acid rain, or they wouldn't deal with gas hydrofracking, or they wouldn't deal with some of the other problems that we were seeing because they had been compromised. So instead of doing a feel-good speech for everyone, I got up there and I laid out the point that when I see the Vice President of the United States and the President of the United States throwing football with the major polluters and the heads of the environmental movement, I know they've both been compromised. And that's exactly what happened. Al Gore and Bill Clinton were two of the worst people to ever be in a position of power as policymakers when it came to the environment. And so I went up and I gave my talk. And it was one of those talks that you expect to be booed or people looking down embarrassing at the fact that they had to sit through this. But I told the truth that we need a brand new environmental movement. We need a whole new way of approaching it. We need to be honest with real science and bring into the room and at the table those environmentalists and scientists who had the truth as their first words, not those who would be ultra, ultra conservative and say, yes, yes, things are going to get worse in 100 years when we're all dead, so who cares? And there were those speaking up at the time. Those individuals who said, we're right now in tipping points, and if we don't come to grips with it, then we're foolish. But those people are nowhere to be found. They're not Cassandras. They're not there to threaten everyone or make them feel bad. They're just there as honest observers with a scientific background to say, we now are out of control. There's no mathematical model that can accurately predict how bad things are going to get. And yet over the last 10 years, we have seen hundreds of thousands of unique weather events, things that only happen once in 500 years, and they've been happening 10, 15 times a year. And yet we don't move, we don't change, nothing changes, nothing at the government level, nothing at the media level. It's just promises and euphemisms. So I see, in my own personal opinion, that we have been betrayed by the Al Gores, by the people who know that if there's going to be money made, they want to make it. They'll say it's all about green, that we'll put windmills out in the ocean, we'll put, you know, more solar panels around, but they're not looking at the real complexity. That's not going to save the planet. Derek Jensen's here to take us on that journey to show us how we save the planet. And by the way, Derek has written many influential books, has recently released Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It. It's perhaps the most important publication to date that exposes the shortcomings and fallacies and self-deceit among the leading green voices and organizations who dominate the public lecture and preaching about climate change and placing faith in technological solutions and new habits of green consumerism. A new documentary film with the same title and based upon Derek's and his co-author's book will premiere on Earth Day, and hopefully you'll have a chance to watch that. Also, Derek hosts a weekly radio program, Resistance Radio, on the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. He holds degrees in mineral engineering, physics from Colorado School of Mines, and a master's in creative writing from Eastern Washington University. His website is Derek Jensen, that's jensen.org, and brightgreenlies.com. Nice to have you with us today, Derek.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you as always.
Derek, you've gone through and analyzed the flaws in many, if not most, of the most prominent solutions, environmental greens. What you call bright green are proposing. These include solar, wind, hydropower, green energy storage, and renewable grid, recycling, and the idea of future green cities. And recently we had a Chappelle on, and he's from Belgium, and he co-authored important work, and he believes very similarly to you. He laid out for us the huge global problem that human civilization has now reached a peak in practically everything. We're therefore somewhere on the verge of a total systems collapse, and he believes it's sooner rather than later. And certainly none of this is on the government's agenda or multinational corporations' agenda or investors' agenda. And in fact, we're denying what we can do about it. So except for allowing big tech to control it all, the Bill Gates to control it. So if you would please take us on a step-by-step of what you see the problems being and what you see the solutions being. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you for all of that. And part of the problem is that once upon a time, the environmental movement was about saving wild places and wild beings. And, you know, Rachel Carson wrote, and it was written of her profound love for the ocean, for birds, for flowers, for wild nature. And she wrote explicitly that this is what motivated her to work. And at some point along the way, and this has happened over the last 30 to 35 years, it's become extreme, that environmentalism has become less about protecting wild places and wild beings and more about finding ways to, quote, sustain this culture so that you can have people like, you know, Lester Brown will write book after book of saying that we talk about saving, or he writes book after book called, you know, Plan B 4.0 to save civilization. He's not saying to save sharks. He's not saying to save redwoods. And he'll make comments like, we talk about saving the planet, but the planet's going to be around for a while. The question is, can we save civilization? And I mean, He's not saying, let's save monarch butterflies. Or Peter Kariva, chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy, more or less constantly pushes the line that, quote, instead of pursuing the protection of biodiversity for biodiversity's sake, a new conservation should seek to enhance these natural systems that benefit the widest number of people, by which he means humans. Conservation will measure its achievement in large part by its relevance to people. Bill McKibben constantly stresses that his work is about saving civilization with quotes like, we're losing the fight badly and quickly, losing it because, most of all, we remain in denial about the peril that human civilization is in. And as we say in the book, we would bet that polar bears, walruses, and glaciers would have preferred that sentence end a different way. And then one more of these quotes, there's a quote from Naomi Klein saying, you know, I've been to more climate marches than I can count, but this is a rough quote, but I have to admit that the polar bears still don't do it for me. And that's part of the problem, is that the real world doesn't do it for us. What does it for us? She says it's all about us. And what all of these people are saying explicitly, you know, I knew this woman many years ago who would say, if somebody tells you something bad about themselves, believe it. And all of these people are considered some of the top environmentalists. You know, Bill McKibben has won awards for being like the top United States environmentalist. And I'm not suggesting anything bad about him personally. I'm not saying he's a jerk. I've heard he's a very nice guy. Everybody says he's very nice. I'm not saying he's corrupt. I'm not saying any of that. What I'm saying is that he is saying explicitly that what he's trying to do is to continue this way of life. And if I had to sum up all of my work in one sentence, it would be, this way of life will not last forever. And when it's over, I would prefer that there be more of the world left rather than less. So the real question I have is, how do we protect the remaining fish in the oceans? How do we protect salmon? How do we protect the polar bears that don't do it for Naomi Klein but do it for me? And so that's part of it. And then I guess I'll go two more directions here. One of them is that what the book is about, well, I'll back up and say this book had its genesis about 10 years ago. I was writing for Orion magazine at the time, and one of the editors at the magazine, not the editor I normally worked with, but a different editor there, tried to set me up in a debate with the person who developed the phrase bright green. And what bright green means is essentially they believe that there are problems, environmental problems, but that these can be solved without a fundamental change in the way we live, and instead primarily through advances in technology. And I would contrast that with my perspective, which is that this way of living is functionally based on destroying the land base and converting the land base into human artifacts. And that will never be sustainable. You can't consume a planet and live on it too. And I'm not saying that one can't be a human being on the planet, because humans have existed on this planet for 200,000 years or however long we've been here. And for the most part, we lived fairly sustainably. I mean, cities only developed 5,000-6,000 years ago. And I live in Northern California, as you said, on the coast, and the Talua Indians lived here for 12,500 years. They've been carbon dated to that far back. And when the Europeans arrived in about 1830, the Klamath River just south of here, even as long as later goes, as recently as 1930s, the Klamath River was still, quote, black and roiling with salmon. There were a lot of people lived here for about 12,000 years. I'm not saying they were perfect. I'm not saying they were, quote, noble savages. They had their own problems. But what we can say definitively is they lived here for 12,000 years and they didn't destroy the place. So humans are capable of living without destroying the place, but humans have not lived with bulldozers for 12,000 years. They haven't lived with cities. I mean, cities are inherently unsustainable, which we'll get to in a minute if you want. Anyway, so So the bright greens believe that the culture is not functionally unsustainable, but that and that therefore technological innovation can sustain things. And I said I would do the debate with this guy on one condition, which is I wanted it to be written. And the reason I wanted it to be written instead of going back and forth like we're doing now is that I just knew in my gut, I didn't even know who the guy was, but I just knew that he was going to make stuff up. And I don't know about you, but my memory isn't good enough that I can normally debate people in the moment, because if they state a mistruth, I would much rather do it in writing, because if they state something that I know is wrong, I can go look it up, and then I can, in writing, point out how they're wrong. Whereas if somebody says a Whopper, I can go, well, I don't think that's right, but I don't have the facts to back it up. So that's exactly, we tried doing it by writing, and it didn't go anywhere. He said that he wanted to do it over the phone. So I said, great, I'll do it over the phone, on the condition that it only gets published if I agree to it, which I never did, because it was so terrible. Anyway, so we start having this discussion, and I point out that that everything we have, I mean, look around the room right now, and you will see, I mean, there's a lamp over here, I'm wearing reading glasses, here's a couch, and all of those items required mining. The lamp over there is made primarily of metal, and it required the entire mining infrastructure to create it. You can't have a lamp with an electrical grid without everything that comes with it. And so I said in the interview that, you know, we have reading glasses, I have lenses made of glass, and modern glassmaking requires energy and transportation infrastructures. The mines for which the materials to make my reading glasses are going to have to be located somewhere, and the energy with which to manufacture them has to come from somewhere. And I said to him, we need to be stopped being guided by the general story that we can have it all, that we can have an industrial culture and also have wild nature, that we can have an oil economy and still have polar bears. And he responded, and this is in the book, which is how I know what it is. He said, it's entirely possible to create a zero-impact, closed-loop, carbon-neutral method of generating prosperity that most people would accept as reasonable. And then he said, you mentioned mining. And he said it is, in fact, possible to recapture minerals and metals, to design things for disassembly so that minerals are easily pulled from objects as they cease to be of use, and to turn those elements into parts for new things. And we know it's at least theoretically possible to have an absolutely zero-waste economy, and we know it's practically possible right now to have a very close to zero-waste economy. And that's really when the whole interview fell apart, because he said all that, and I'm like, oh, that makes no sense. But I didn't have the facts. So once we got off the phone, I'd spent 10 years writing this book. Anyway, once we got off the phone, it took me like 10 minutes to find out that, oh, I don't know the numbers. Here's the problem, but they're in the book. Currently, copper is actually pretty easily recyclable, but only, I think, like 37% of the copper that's used is actually recycled, because demand is so great that you have to keep bringing new online. And then I looked up more, and I found that recycling takes incredibly high temperatures. Recycling most metals takes incredibly high temperatures. And how do you do that sustainably? How do you get 4,000 degrees Celsius sustainably? How do you do that? And it also creates hugely toxic byproducts, even something as simple as aluminum. And also, there are various grades and alloys. I mean, it gets really complicated really quickly. We have been pushed that recycling will save the planet, but no. And so then I started thinking, what about all the other lies? You know, if you type in the phrase solar will save the planet, you'll get like thousands or tens of thousands of responses on the internet search. But solar panels don't grow on trees. They come from somewhere. What are the materials? What materials are they made of? How do they? What is involved in the manufacture? What happens when they're done? Are they toxic? Do they create toxic waste? And nobody's answering these questions. They're just, so long and short of it is that this co-optation has been so extreme that by now you can have 100,000 people marching on the streets of New York or Paris or D.C., and if you ask these individuals, why are you marching, they will say, we're marching to save the planet. And if you ask them for their demands, they will say, we want more subsidies for the wind and solar industries. And that's extraordinary, that co-optation. So basically, that the environmental movement, much of it, I'm not saying all of it, there are tremendous grassroots environmentalists out there, and there are even some fairly large organizations, not like Greenpeace or any of those. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking local Greenpeace chapters can be good, just like local Sierra Club chapters can be good. National, not so much. And there's other organizations like Wild Earth Guardians that are still pretty good. They're still good. And, God, I'm blanking. But there's a couple other pretty good organizations. But the point is that, for the most part, environmental organizations have been turned into a lobbying arm of a sector of industrial capitalism. And that's extraordinary. It's like having a anti-war movement. You have this, you know, 100,000 people marching, and we want to stop war. Well, what do you want? Well, we want subsidies for, I don't know, this particular industry. And it's just extraordinary that they've been turned into that lobbying arm. And you'll see, I mean, I see articles yesterday and today and the day before, I've seen articles about how a great environmental victory because they're going to give trillions, Biden's going to give trillions, wants to give trillions of dollars to the solar industry. And I'm sorry, if you ask desert tortoises if they want their land converted to a giant solar harvesting facility, I think they would say no. And in fact, this is one of the things we quote in the book, is that I want to find this exact number because it's really, really horrifying.
Good opening culture, statement.
Just one last thing. According to one study that was in PLOS, between now and 2050, solar and wind development threatened to destroy as much land as urban sprawl and expansion of oil and gas, coal, and mining combined. Solar development outranks agricultural expansion and wind, which are tied for second place, as the single largest development threat to habitat considered in the study. And that should send a chill down everyone's bones. And we can get into this later, too, if you want. But wind and solar can't even functionally replace oil anyway. This is all just a con on that. It just adds on to the top. Anyway, sorry, what was your question?
Your estimation, which environmental organizations do you consider best represent the bright green movement?
Oh, you know, honestly, most of the big ones. Most of the big ones are far more interested in, as you said, I mean, a lot of them are, I mean, they've got, oh God, what was it? This is old news. This is 30 years ago, but the head of the National Wildlife Federation, when he left, that was Jay Hare, when he left, he immediately went to work for Plum Creek Timber Company as a PR flack. And there's this revolving door. One of the people who was on the board of waste management was also on the board of one of the big, as some people say, gangrene. So the big ones that are very bright green would be, you know, Sierra Club, Audubon. Again, I want to be really clear. I'm not talking about local chapters. There can be big, strong fights between local chapters and the national organization. Anyway, Audubon, Sierra Club, National Wildlife Federation, 350.org, they're all banking heavily. I don't know if banking is a pun or not. They're all banking heavily on all this bright green. They're pushing really hard, which puts a lot of local activists in a real dilemma, because I was talking to a guy about desert tortoises 6 months ago, and the organization he works with, he himself is working desperately to save desert tortoises. That's all great. And then the organization of which he's a part is also pushing for solar, which requires lithium mines. These lithium mines are harming other habitat. they're putting in solar facilities on, not they, the organization, but they, the government and large corporations are putting in solar facilities on desert tortoise habitat. So his organization is put in this bind of, do we support the solar or do we support the desert tortoises? And that's, to me, that doesn't seem a bind at all, because if you're an environmental organization, you should be supporting the tortoises no matter what.
Okay. I would like for you to deal with our solar power issues, because we've been led to believe by Al Gore and tens of thousands of acolytes of him that you can get rich and you can become green with solar. All right? It's not true, and you're going to break down why it's not true, but the average person who, if you say, are you concerned about the outcome of the polar bears or the wild salmon or the walruses or the desert turtles? They say, yes. Are you concerned about people having to move entire communities out of the Amazon because it's being overexploited and logged, and therefore the lungs of the planet are drying out? Yeah, I'm concerned. Are you concerned about the slowing down of the great, the heat that is transferred from the southern climates around Florida and further down, clear up around Iceland, Greenland, coming back, bringing cold water? But that's slowing down, and that could have catastrophic events happen because of it. I didn't know about it, but I'm concerned. Are you concerned about the melting of the great glaciers, the Himalayas, that feed 7 of the world's largest rivers and over 2 billion people their daily water? And it's major slowdown of that water. Are you concerned about the excessive drought in the United States, covering 20 states, and it's not going away? It's going to be here for your entire lifetime and the next 5 lifetimes. I didn't know it. Yeah. So does it make sense to learn about this so you know which states to go to, like, for example, Wisconsin, which has water, and Vermont that has water, Massachusetts, Maine has water, but Texas, half of Texas doesn't, Oklahoma's out of water, Colorado, you're looking at Kansas, yeah, and a lot of states have too much water and flooding it out. So what you would traditionally do is to go to a place because it would provided you a future, but now you have to ask, will there be a sustainable future if I live on the east coast of the United States, say in the down around Homestead or Miami or Fort Lauderdale, Boca, West Palm Beach? And the answer is no. Then why are they continuing to build there like it's crazy day with developers and along the west coast and along the Gulf Coast as well? Why are we not making any moves from any place that is not sustainable? Why aren't governors being honest about the unique weather forecast with dust storms, sand storms, water bombs, flooding where there had never been flooding, and drought where there had never been drought, making it no longer a sustainable habitat? So we, at the one time, we will say, yes, I care, but do you know what goes into your cell phone? Do you know what goes into your laptop computer? Do you know where that material comes from? On that electric car, what is actually powering the electric car? Is it the battery? How did they make the battery? And where does the battery get charged? Through an electrical outlet. And what supplies power to it? Oh, your nuclear power plant or your fossil fuel power plant? These contradictions are not addressed anywhere right now in the environmental movement. We're being told one story or another. We're either denying completely global warming, like Tucker Carlson, or at least the human cause of it, or we're told everything can be straightened out as long as we leave it up to the business community and big tech, or we're simply indifferent. Could you break this down and show us, starting with solar, the myths of solar and wind, and what we should be doing in their place?
Well, thank you for all that. And you frankly broke it down really well. I thought that was just a perfect job. And, you know, in Jeff Gibbs and Ozzie Zenner's recent fabulous movie, Planet of the Humans, one of the lines that really struck me was, can we use the machines of civilization to solve the problems created by the machines of civilization? And that's really what they're asking of. I mean, that's what the Bright Greens are asking of us, is they're saying, yes, so you can. And Jeff Gibbs and Ozzie Zenner and Max and Lear and I are all saying, no, you can't. And Solar is a great example. I want to, before we really talk about solar, okay, I guess one way to dive in would be we hear all the time that, you know, Munich is pledged to go 100% renewable energy, or Los Angeles is pledged to go 100% renewable energy. We hear this constantly. There's like 100 cities in the United States that have, and one state, and the thing is, they're even lying on that level, because those cities are not pledging to go 100% renewable energy. They're pledging to go 100% renewable electricity, and that's a difference. And that's fine if a neurosurgeon or a cricket player or a MMA fighter or your next door neighbor doesn't know the difference between energy and electricity, but it's not okay if a climate activist or an environmentalist saying that these things, or a politician saying that they're going 100% renewable energy, makes that mistake, because electricity is only about 20% of total energy use around the world. That there are boilers that heat buildings that burn oil or coal. There are, when my mom lived in Spokane, she had a natural gas furnace. There are cars, you know, that all of those things. So electricity is only about 20%. So when they say they're pledging to go 100% renewable, first off, you have to take 80% off the top of any of their numbers, because so it drops it to 20%. But then you have to reduce it more, because when they say renewable, what they're really, the majority of, quote, renewable is biomass. And biomass is a fancy way of saying either growing a crop like corn or turnips and then turning it into fuel, or cutting down forests, pelleting the trees, and burning them. So when they say that Munich is going 100% renewable energy, what they really mean, first off, is they're going 20% renewable energy, and the majority of that is simply cutting down forests. And this is being pushed by environmental groups as green, and it's counted as carbon neutral. It's counted as carbon neutral because the trees sequestered the carbon at some point, and now we're cutting them down, and we're going to burn them, and then they will sequester the carbon again at some point in the future. And that's crazy. That's crazy for a couple levels. First off, that would be like you putting money in the bank. I take it out, and then you're eventually going to put more in that I'm going to take out again, and we all call this money neutral. Money was put in the bank, and money was taken out, so who cares? No, we're actually taking it. I'm actually taking it from you. And second, it's crazy because it's presuming, there's a bunch of assumptions that are just nuts. One of them is that it's presuming that the forest will regrow, and that's not a given, given what we've seen about deforestation on the planet. And there is no forest in the world that has survived more than three rotations, because, as John Livingston famously said, there is no surplus in nature. You can't keep taking all of that biomass out of the forest and expect the forest to survive. And another reason it's crazy is because forests and trees both sequester more carbon each year as they get older. So if you cut down a forest and then start it up again, and let it start itself up again, I should say, that's not, you've lost all of that carbon, not only that you took out, but also that would have been sequestered by those old trees. And so it's fallacious on every level. Another example of bogus carbon accounting, we'll get to solar in a second. Another example of bogus carbon accounting is they call dams carbon neutral. They say, oh, Costa Rica is this wonderful eco-paradise because they get 100% of their energy from hydro. Okay, first, okay, we all know the drill by now. It's actually 20% because hydro only produces electricity or generates electricity. It doesn't generate anything to put in your motorcycle. And second, dams kill, the only good thing you can say environmentally about dams is eventually they fail. Dams kill the river, they kill the land underneath, they kill fish who need to swim up or down the river, they kill lots, they kill insects who rely on the riparian zones, et cetera, et cetera. And also, they're not even carbon neutral. They've been called methane bombs because because everything at the bottom of the reservoir decays anaerobically, and then as the water goes through the turbines, the methane is released. So greenhouse gases, hydro is actually worse than burning coal, and I'm not arguing for burning coal. Hydro is actually worse than burning coal in terms of greenhouse gases, but it's considered carbon neutral. It's considered zero carbon, and it's just more accounting shenanigans, but it's accounting. But accounting doesn't matter in the real world. What's real is what matters in the real world. So you have to drop their numbers for that. So the point of this is the great German miracle that we heard so much about is actually about, I think, wind and solar generate about, I don't remember what it was. It's about 3%, 4% of Germany's energy. And that number has not dramatically increased. Part of the problem, this is where we come to next, part of the problem is something called the Jevons paradox, which people have to understand. It's maybe the most important thing I'm going to say today. The Jevons paradox, he was an economist back in the 19th century who studied efficiency and use of coal. And he went into the study thinking, well, when you have an increase in how efficiently you can use coal, you know, as they made the burners more, the boilers more efficient, et cetera, as you increase the use of efficiency, that should decrease coal use because, you know, it takes less to heat up the boiler that's now going to run the steam engine. So if you only use half as much, great, reduction in coal use. But what he found was the opposite, which is why it's called a paradox, that he found that increased efficiency in use of an energy source, coal in this case, actually increased demand. And the reason it increased demand, it makes sense when you think about it, that if you are running a business and you decrease the cost, one of your costs of your inputs, it would be nice if you just took that extra money that you saved and, you know, spent it to take holidays and to walk around and you know, walk next to a stream with your children. But that's not what happens. What happens is you build up your business bigger. So if you use half as much coal to run a locomotive, well, what we're going to do is we're going to make two locomotives now. We're going to run two trains per day instead of one. So you're actually increasing total demand for everything. And this is what's happened with energy, that when they, you know, for thousands of years, the primary source of human, of energy that was used by humans, well, the primary source was human and non-human slavery, you know, draft animals and also draft humans that were forced to work for you. But in addition to that, the primary source was wood. And then when they started burning coal, wood use didn't decrease. Coal added on. And then when they found oil, coal and wood did not decrease. Oil added on. And then when they started having hydro in the 1930s, coal, oil, and wood did not decrease. Every time in nuclear they add that on, it doesn't matter. They add on. So all of this solar that they're adding is simply adding on. It is not in any way decreasing coal and oil use. The only thing that has ever decreased energy use was the economic collapse of 2008. Economic contraction is what decreases energy use. So it's just a lie when they say we need to build solar facilities to replace oil. It's not what happens. It never happens that way. It adds on to the top. It's just we're paying all these trillions of dollars or billions of dollars, however much it ends up being, that are paid to make solar facilities does not decrease oil. It's just a gift to the energy companies because they want more oil. They want more energy that can be used to for Bitcoin mining, can be used for just in the last few, just like 10 years. Prior to 10 years ago, indoor marijuana growing was fairly small because it was illegal. And especially prior to 25 years ago, it was almost non-existent. And now, I don't remember the numbers on this. We've got them in the book, but like marijuana use is one of the top 10 electrical uses in the United States. I might be lying on that, but it's a huge use. around the country. And this is just a brand new use. Or 30 years ago, there was no need for server farms. There was no such thing as a server farm, really, 50 years ago. And now that's a new form. So as they decrease the cost of electricity, which isn't really happening, but if they did decrease the cost of electricity, all they would do is find new uses for it. That's what happens every single time. And so it's just complete crap to say that this actually helps the world. All it does is create a new source of energy for... And also, it's functionally irreplaceable. Because here's the thing, is that wind and solar, hydro, all of those only generate electricity. And AC electricity cannot be stored. And so forget dams, because you can keep the water behind the dam for release later. But wind and solar produce energy only when it's sunny or when it's windy, which means you have to have backup systems anyway in order to, because you can't have all the ventilators turn off at a hospital. You can't have all the factories shut down because the wind stops blowing. So there's huge storage problems with this. And the primary means of storage, I mean, there's lithium, of course, that we've all heard of, but 99% of the grid scale, 96% of the grid scale electrical storage in the world is pumped hydro. And all pumped hydro is big honking dams that you have two dams and you pump water from the lower one up to the upper one when the sun's shining. And then when it's not shining anymore, you let the water run back down. This is all incredibly environmentally expensive, incredibly expensive financially. And again, none of this helps the planet. And they're trying to just find ways to, this is the most important thing, they're trying to find ways to continue to power the destruction. But even if they could figure out ways to make battery-operated chainsaws, the tree doesn't care whether it's cut down by a chainsaw powered by gas or by solar. The truth is, we should be making less chainsaws. And then one last thing here is that, again, look around and ask yourself how many trucks were used to carry everything you see around you. That lamp I mentioned earlier, there were the trucks to build the roads to the mine. There were the trucks used in mining. There were the trucks to carry the ore from the mine to the smelter. There's the trucks to carry the stuff to the place where it's manufactured. There's the trucks to carry it to the store. I mean, and who knows how many trucks in between. And diesel has an energy, can hold 46 megajoules per kilogram. It doesn't matter what a megajoule is or a kilogram is. The point is the number, 46. And lithium batteries can store about 1 megajoule per kilogram. And so diesel is much more energy dense. And the reason this is important is because if you have a 60,000-pound payload on a diesel semi and it can go 600 miles on a tank of diesel, in order to go that same distance, it would have to have 55,000 pounds of batteries, which leaves you a 5,000-pound payload. That's not functionally replaceable. So my point is, A, they're bad for the planet, which is what I care about, but these things functionally won't replace, they won't run the economy either, which is what they care about. So it's a lie on the level of being good for the planet, and it's a lie on the level of it will even run the economy. And so one of my big problems with all this is all of this discussion, not the one you and I are having, but the one that's being foisted on us by Al Gore, et cetera, it wastes time we don't have on solutions that won't work, and even if they did, they wouldn't help the sea turtles, they wouldn't help the humans who are being driven off their land in the Amazon. They don't help any of this, and that is what I find horrifying and heartbreaking. We're wasting time we don't have in a desperate situation.
Those insights. Derek, and we're listening to Derek Jensen, that's DerrickJensen. He has a radio program on the Progressive Radio Network, a very good program every weekend on Sunday, so I hope people have a chance to listen to it. Excuse me. And Derek also has a new documentary film that will be coming out on the bright green lies, how the environmental movement lost its way and what we can do about it. That's the same title as the new book. But Derek, I'd like to take you in a little different direction now, if you would. And that is, go back to the beginning of the Wall Street challenges after we saw that the big banks were bailed out, after we saw that those who caused the 2008 collapse were not taken out of business. They were not taken through structured bankruptcy and held accountable. They were all bailed out. All their debts were, in effect, cleaned up by the Federal Reserve. And yet small businesses and people trying to live within their means and consciously, none of them were bailed out. It was one of the greatest separations in my lifetime to show who we care about, the rich and powerful, and who we don't care at all about, everyone else. And so I went down to Occupy Wall Street. I was there on the day one, and I was there for the next 22 days because I really believe that these young people who were yelling out at Wall Street, you're 1% and you're greedy, well, A, I brought it to their attention, it's not 1%. But it was a good kind of myth. I said, how many professionals do we have? I don't know. Well, we have 17 million. These are people, lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, scientists. These are people like CPAs and architects. These are people who could have easily $1 million in net income total and not including real estate. So they count. Then you got 10 million millionaires. They count. And you don't have a lot of billionaires. That time it was around 200 in the United States, 400 worldwide. So you're really dealing with their family members. So you got about 70 million people who are the problem. They're the largest users of energy. And they never seem to have enough to be enough to stop getting more. And so they have this insatiable appetite. And I said, so you're dealing with about 15% of the American population. That's not 1%. And that's on the low side. Now, take a look. Who drives opinions? Who drives styles? Who drives, let's all go eat sushi? Who drives this? The rich and powerful. They're the opinion leaders and policymakers. Who are the politicians? Policymakers. So the people who could control the future are completely removed from any consequences of what everyone's doing now. They want the economy to grow, gross domestic product, 3%, 5%. China, for almost 20 years, 15%. More or less, between 10 to 15%. And even now they're at about 6%. The United States has been negative the last year, but it, again, was on like 4%. That means that every year the environment was being completely exploited so that you could have your next iPad, you could have your next gadget, your next, you know, little enhancer, 5G. Everybody wanted the smart city that has controlled by the smart grid, that has a smart refrigerator, that has a smart toilet, that has everything smart. You understand, though, that it's monitoring and monetizing every single thing in your life, every conversation, everything. It's filming, but they don't seem to care. So I asked these people, I said, here we go. What are you against? Corporate America. Okay, good. Not all corporations are bad, but let's say those that are bad and greedy, you are against. I would agree with you. So which ones? And then they were kind of stymied. And I said, well, let me take a look. And there was a group in front of me. Thank goodness I had a camera guy and we were filming this. There were about nine. I said, here's my wallet. What you don't see are major credit cards. If I put my money into something, it would be a credit union, or some place where I know that they're not going to use my money to engage in derivatives or credit default swaps. I said, but you all have, and they were opening their wallets, you have every single major bank there. Now, right across the street Bank of America. Are you going to protest there? You're also eating hamburgers, drinking colas. You're wearing Calvin Klein clothes and Tommy Hilfiger hats. Your clothes were made in Bangladesh at exploiting women at 14 cents an hour, shortening their lifespans. So are you feeling at all responsible for any of the things that you feel that are the problem? Are you contributing and enabling the problem? Are you able to get off the grid? Then they got angry. You know, they got angry that I had just simply highlighted, made obvious what they seemed to be clueless and cognitively disconnected from. And I said, so one of them said, well, what are you doing then? I said, well, it's simple. I'm a vegan. I'm a certified organic farmer. Since 1971 at the Fertiller Farm upstate, I've taught tens of thousands of people about how to get back to the land, get off the grid. I don't eat anything with a face or a heartbeat. I try to buy everything locally made or grown, and I only buy what I need. So if I don't need something, I don't buy it. My house is completely 100% solar powered. In fact, you could look at the meter. You know, so it's, you know, my solar down in Florida is covering that. I said, but understand something. I have a high quality of life. I just don't have a high standard of living by your concepts. And by the way, all those young people, all of their parents were professionals. And I said, so do you know what good you would do if you started encouraging planting 1 billion trees in New Jersey, 1 billion in New York, 1 billion in Connecticut, the immediate surrounding states, and getting your parents, who are opinion leaders or even policymakers, to set up campaigns one block at a time, one neighborhood at a time, one city at a time? We could do this. I gave him examples of a man in India who took a desert area and over 30 years had completely regrown the whole area. It's about 160 acres. He did it all himself. There are other people who have done similarly around the world, and they are an inspiration. I said, but think of what you would do if you knew that you didn't have to go buy anything new, nothing new, and use what you have, and downsize. Downsize to a more austere life so you appreciate what you have instead of this constant need to purchase stuff you don't need. Whether you can afford it or not, it's the secondary, but it all creates energy when you're producing that. And so an exploitation of labor and exploitation of resources. So I said, so simple things that you can do. Down on my ranch, and I have in Florida, I don't have city water. I don't have city septic. I have my own leach fields. I have my own wells. You know, I have my own filtration system. So I don't, you know, I bring the water up I need, and I try to live within 7 gallons a day unless it's unusual. So when they heard all this, it kind of, they just got angrier. They didn't get more curious. So what we have today in the United States, if not much of the world, in my opinion, Derek, is we have people who will say something that is politically correct, but they're not living it, nor will they live it. Even Greta Thunberg. Now, her words are legitimate, but there's nothing behind it except people, in my opinion, exploiting her for carbon capture and these other deals that there's always someone trying to exploit. And she does not get deserve the credit because there was nothing fundamentally changed because of it. Now, she was here. People got out on a Friday, but the world didn't change. These people didn't become vegans. So we need to do things at the local level, individual level, at the collective level, because I do not believe any time in the future, in our lifetimes, you're going to see the state or federal governments make any changes necessary to slow it down. So we have to individually take that responsibility and then look at in the world where we can sustain a life during our lifetime where it's not going to be sustainable in a lot of places where they're clueless. Your thoughts, please.
Well, thank you for that. And I think that I really like, I mean, there are things that we can do that are, well, there's a few directions I want to go. One of them is that I recognize we're also running out of time. That back in the 70s, I'm sure you remember too, that the phrase was reduce, reuse, and recycle. And funny how between the 70s and now, the sort of reduce and reuse, or I guess it's reuse, reduce, whichever order that goes, reduce, reuse. I guess between then and now, the first two have been dropped off, and we don't hear those so often anymore. You know, hear about recycling is going to save the planet, but the truth is that what we should do first is reduce and reuse. But the reason those got dropped off pretty quickly is because they don't serve capitalism. You can't make money off of them. Who makes money off of the fact that you wear your clothes until they, you know, get holes all over them, and then you turn them into rags, which is what people did forever until not very long ago. And
this, let me interrupt you. We're coming up, unfortunately, to the end of the program. Let us make this part one and come back for next week and do part two, because I've got as much information that I'd like for you to share as we did today in another whole program, all right?
This is great.
So Derek Jensen's my guest. We'll invite him back, and we will be back here for another hour on the Progressive Commentary Hour, Conversations with Remarkable Minds with Derek Jensen. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.